This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom has the day off, and I'm sitting in today. I'm delighted to be here. My name's Peter B. Collins, and I join you from the glorious city of San Francisco on the left coast of these United States, and we've got a lot to talk about. As you know, Tom and Louise Hartman are in Dubrovnik, in the former Yugoslavia, and that's a place I visited once many, many years ago, so I'm slightly jealous. It's a beautiful place now that peace has returned. And that, of course, is the focus of the conference that Tom is attending and participating in. We've got a lot to talk about. There's a verdict in, not a verdict, actually, the sentence has been announced in the Scooter Libby conviction. And next hour, we're going to be joined by a former assistant U.S. attorney, Elizabeth De La Vega. You may have read her in the blogosphere. Just yesterday, she posted a piece at Tom Dispatch that was also at truthout.org that correctly predicted that the sentence would be 30 months. And she disclaimed any prior knowledge of the judge's deliberations. So she'll be joining us about an hour from now to talk about that. We'll also talk today about the stunning indictment that's finally been returned against Dollar Bill Jefferson, Congressman William Jefferson from Louisiana. He's the one with that stack of marked cash that was found in his freezer. He's got a lot of explaining to do, that's for sure. Also today on the Tom Hartman Program, we're going to have a little fun. We're going to pull back the curtain on the GOP fundraising machinery. Last week, I got a call from a guy who claimed to be named Bradford Limley, and he invited me to the White House as part of some small business advisory group. So we played along, and it was fascinating. You'll hear the result a little bit later today here on the Tom Hartman Program. But to kick things off today, we're joined by one of the two Democrats who serves on the five-member Federal Communications Commission. He is Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. Commissioner, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Well, it's my pleasure. And you were part of an announcement that occurred in the past hour or so regarding an interesting study that was conducted and released and is available online at freepress.net regarding the sorry state of affairs in American media when it comes to the influence of women and minorities. And that influence can be measured either in management positions in corporate media outlets or in ownership of properties themselves. What is the current state of minority representation in the electronic media regulated by the FCC, Commissioner?
The current state is dismal, I would say. We have an incredible lack of women and minority ownership of radio and television stations. And today we announced, for example, that women, who are more than half the population, only own 6% of the radio stations, and minorities are 33%, a third of the country, own only 7.7% of the stations. So the situation is bad, it's getting worse, and it's even worse in television. So what you learn is that when women are get angry or minorities get angry about the way they're stereotyped, misrepresented, underrepresented in the media, it is probably a function of the fact that women and minorities don't own the stations that are broadcasting this material that is so upsetting to so many people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the report also cites that where women have risen to the ranks, say, of radio station ownership, they're involved in a single station, not in the kind of clusters that the corporate owners have been able to build under deregulation.
That's right. The real message there is that we can't afford more media consolidation where these media giants gobble up more and more stations. The previous chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell, attempted the most dramatic rollback of our media ownership protections in the history of American broadcasting. And there was an uprising in the country from left to right and everybody in between. Me and my cops on the commission fought it, but the courts finally put the whole thing on ice and sent it back to us. So now we're trying to decide, should we allow big media to get even bigger? I think not, and we're going to need the American people to speak up and to comment and to let us know how they feel about it.
Well, you and Commissioner Copps have done incredible work over the past 4 or 5 years, crisscrossing the country, meeting with diverse community groups and outraged citizens, working what you could as the minority members of this commission. And I give you high marks for that and a great appreciation, because you have been able to galvanize public opinion, and that has helped offset your lack of the third vote on the commission. The courts have also helped, and the group out of Philadelphia, the low-power radio or former pirate guys who filed that lawsuit, are to be commended as well. But going forward, what's the current status of these issues at the commission, particularly the ownership caps for television?
Well, it's all back in our lab now, thanks to that court decision in Philadelphia that put the whole decision back to us, basically sent it back to the FCC to get it right and start from scratch. We've got everything back on the table again. I'm in Chicago right now on this very issue. I met yesterday with leaders of the African-American community, the Latino community, and the religious community, all of which are really appalled by the state of ownership of minorities and women and want to do something about it. So we're really ready to organize, to make sure that we take on this issue, because it matters to so many different issues. Whether your main issue is war and peace or education or healthcare, the media is the lens through which all of this is refracted. So if you're worried about any of these issues, we better make sure there's a diverse media so that the real story can get out.
Well, and you're not going to hear about these issues in the corporate media. We saw in the last cycle that there was precious little coverage by the main networks and the cable networks of these issues at the FCC. We're talking with Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein here on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins. And, Commissioner, give us one or two ways that our listeners can actively and constructively participate in this dialogue.
Well, there actually is a docket open right now at the FCC. You go to FCC.gov and look up the media ownership docket, and you file a comment, say what you think about media consolidation. Last time around, 3 million people contacted the FCC. We didn't even know there were 3 million people in the country that knew we existed.
Oh, come on. There are a lot of CB radios out there.
Well, they managed to find us, and we need you all to find us again and to weigh in and to let us know how you feel about this issue, you know, whatever side of the issue that you're on. You know, 99% of the people seem to think it's a bad idea to let big media get bigger, but people need to take the time to organize. You know, we're ready to come to communities across the country and hold hearings. We try to get the FCC to go to as many as we can. We also are willing to go out on our own and talk to people in the community and find out what's happening in cities across the country. We've been to 40 or 50 cities so far. We're ready to take this on the road. So if you want to contact my office in Washington or the FCC, we're willing to take it to the people, because after all, it's the public airways, and the public ought to be the ones who tell us what's in their interest, rather than those of us in Washington somehow thinking we know better what's in the public interest than the people themselves.
And we're talking about a report that you can read online at freepress.net. It was just released today about the sorry state of affairs regarding minority participation in broadcast ownership and management. And I also direct you to the website mediamatters.org, where they have done some excellent work surveying the guests, for example, on the Sunday morning political talk shows, and showing how women and minorities really only spiked in their representation for a week or two after the Don Imus controversy, and now it's back to white male dominance as it was before. Commissioner Adelstein, I can't help but ask you about the court ruling yesterday that dinged the FCC for its effort to rein in so-called indecency. Your group, I don't want to make this personal, but the commissioners were cited by the court for arbitrary and capricious decision-making. And they said that some of the vulgar words, like Bono's F-bomb on an award show a couple of years ago, are similar to off-the-cuff remarks from President Bush and Vice President Cheney. What's your reaction to this court ruling?
Well, I actually was the one commissioner who dissented in part from the decision that the court overruled. I've been concerned that the FCC has been a little bit sloppy in how it's approached this issue, and we just got slapped down by the courts for the first time in history. This is the first time the courts have said that the FCC has overstepped its authority. The problem is that when we do that, and the courts say that you're going too far under the Constitution, we can never get our authority back. They're saying that the Constitution prevents us from regulating certain things because of the way that we did it. Now we're going to be in a more difficult position to try to protect children from material that's inappropriate over the airwaves. So I think that we've been I think, overzealous in how we've approached this. We've overstepped our bounds. And we told the courts that we'd walk a tightrope. Well, we just fell off.
Okay. The court ruled we are skeptical that the commission can provide a reasoned explanation for its fleeting expletive regime that would pass constitutional muster. And I support that. I you know, the intentional use of provocative language or indecent depictions, I can understand your desire to regulate. But off-the-cuff comments, really the regulation just dares people to try to push the boundaries.
Well, you've got a point. There's a real distinction that the court is making between fleeting and unplanned use and planned use. But it's possible that this decision ultimately could prevent us from preventing even a sitcom from using language that we don't want our kids to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the purpose of indecency regulation, people always get mad at me and say, "Why? What are you trying to do? Are you a big nanny?" We're not trying to protect adults. Adults actually have a constitutional right under the First Amendment to indecent material. It's actually protected. But children are the ones we're trying to protect.
Yeah.
And how do you do that in a sensitive way? When you do it in this kind of politicized way, what was done here in this decision, and the courts slap you down because we did such a sloppy job of trying to explain it, then ultimately we might not be able to even keep these words off the air in context when we might all agree it would be inappropriate.
Right, and it's compounded by your lack of regulatory authority over cable and satellite, and it's a tough set of issues, but I think the court ruled properly there. Commissioner, thank you for your time today, and thanks for the work you're doing on ownership.
Well, thank you for having us on, and thank goodness for Air America.
FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. Your phone calls are next at 866-303-2270. On the Tom Hartman Program, I'm Peter B. Collins.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, coast to coast on Air America Radio. It's 22 minutes after the hour. I'm your humble host, Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom Hartman today, tomorrow, and Friday. He'll be back with you live on Thursday from Dubrovnik, Croatia. And he was really fried. If you listened yesterday, he flew all day and then stayed up all night to watch the Democrats on CNN. I don't call those things a debate. It was a joint appearance where they were peppered with questions. But I give Tom Hartman a whole lot of credit. He's one of the hardest working people in talk radio and sets a standard for all of us to try to keep up with. We'll go to the phones here in a moment. You're welcome to call the program. You know the number, toll free, 866-303-2270. But I wanted to throw out a couple of topics for you to chew on. First of all, it's taken 2 years, but Dollar Bill Jefferson was indicted by the grand jury yesterday. And I didn't give him that nickname. Constituents in Louisiana named him Dollar Bill because when he was on the Ways and Means Committee, he used to bring home that pork barrel cash to Louisiana. And he got pretty comfortable, it appears, because he's the one who had the $90,000 in bribe money marked FBI bills in his freezer. And on camera, he accepted the money. And I will certainly suspend judgment until a court has found him guilty. But I do believe that Nancy Pelosi is correct, and he should resign and resign soon so that he can spend more time with the family that he tried to spread the bribe money around to and also focus on his criminal defense. Again, I'm not prejudging him, but the evidence is so overpowering. The stench, you can pick it up from Washington almost anywhere you are in this country. And I don't believe that Democrats should be protected when they are apparently in violation of the law. And that appears to be the case with Bill Jefferson. Also, over the weekend, another terror plot was busted up. At least that's the report we were given. Some guys, including some people who have been baggage handlers at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, stand accused of trying to blow up the jet fuel depots there at JFK. And there appears to be the outlines of a conspiracy here. But the day two story in the New York Times was headlined, "Court Papers Portray Plot as More Talk Than Action." The subhead, "Money and Training Are Called Lacking." And when you drill down, these guys talked about doing something. And the thing that links them to many of the other terrorist cases that have been busted up in this country is that there's a government-paid informant at the center of it. And when the story unravels, I think it will be much less than met the eye on its first blush. Let's take some calls here. Kyle in San Rafael, California, a beautiful town. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program. I'm Peter B.
Hi, Peter. I am following the Scooter Libby trial, like many of us who are Air America fans, very closely over at FireDogLake.com, mm-hmm. where Marcy Wheeler, also known as Empty Wheel, has been in the courtroom and, again, as many of you know, doing the best work on the up-to-the-minute reports.
Indeed, I've talked with Marcy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we have now heard, as you mentioned earlier, that Mr. Libby has been sentenced to 30 months
right,
and a $250,000 fine.
Correct.
The fine doesn't impress a lot of us very much because that can be raised by his friends very quickly. But the 30 months is a big, big chunk of time mm-hmm. for someone like Scooter Libby to have to be looking at. However, and again, I'm sure many of us are aware of this, the big issue today, this morning, right now, and my finger is getting worn out hitting the refresh button on my computer, is whether he's going to have to go in or he will be released on appeal.
All right, so Kyle, what do you think would be true justice here? Should he be celled with Paris Hilton, or should we reserve an ocean view suite at Guantanamo with free waterboarding on a daily basis?
Obviously something between those extremes, but those of us who are big fans of the corrective remedy of impeachment
mm-hmm.
really want to see him go into jail this week, because if he does, it gives Dennis Kucinich's impeachment for Cheney resolution some new impetus. And that, of course, would be based on the fact that Cheney's chief of staff is now in jail.
Right.
So, to me, this is big, big stuff. And
all right,
hope
Kyle.
I hope that we get what we want.
Thanks for your call. We're going to talk with a former U.S. attorney, an assistant U.S. attorney, who correctly pegged the 30-month sentence. Elizabeth De La Vega will join us about a half an hour from now. And we'll talk more about this here on the Tom Hartman program. Sitting in for Tom today, I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
How about now? We continue on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins from San Francisco, sitting in for Tom today, tomorrow, and Friday. Tom will be back with you live from Dubrovnik over there in Croatia on Thursday. And if you want to drop me an email, my personal email is peter@peterbcollins.com. There's a website at peterbcollins.com where you can find out more about me and hook up to my West Coast radio program, their archives and all that kind of stuff there. Brad Friedman joins us right now. He is the proprietor of bradblog.com and a leading advocate of election protection in this country. And there is a major threat that most people are not aware of that is going to surface possibly as soon as tomorrow on the floor of the House of Representatives. It's called the Holt Bill. And its origins were very positive. And the way the bill has taken shape in committee is quite distressing to activists like Brad Friedman. Brad, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good to be here, Peter. How are you?
Nice to talk with you, as usual. And, Brad, enumerate for people what's in the Holt bill that is problematic and why it will not fix the problems that we're so familiar with related to electronic voting and other aspects of our election systems as we've seen them go sideways in 2000 and 2004 and in many other elections aside from the presidential races.
Going sideways is a very nice way to put it, Peter. Well, it's a large bill. It's got a lot of stuff in it. It's got some very good stuff in it. However, most troubling is that it will allow these terrible touchscreen voting machines, so-called DRE, or direct recording electronic devices, to continue to be used essentially forever. Now, this is rather extraordinary, given the fact that down in Florida, the Florida governor down there, Republican governor, has figured out that there is a problem with these touchscreen machines. The Florida Republican legislatures have figured it out, and they've actually outlawed them in Florida. But incredibly enough, we've finally got election reform coming to Congress now that Democrats are in charge, and they are allowing these touchscreen machines to continue. And they're saying that as long as there's a paper trail, they can be used. Now, these machines, they'll kick out a paper trail on the side of the machine, but the dirty secret is no one ever counts those paper trails. And, in fact, NYU's Brennan Center for Justice and other people have described how easy it is to hack these touchscreen machines, even with a paper trail, and make it such that the paper trail itself actually matches the internal numbers on these touchscreen machines. So in other words, when you go to vote on one of these touchscreen machines, even if you verify this so-called paper trail, the secret is that paper trail is not actually counted. What's counted is the numbers inside the machine that you can never verify, and there's no way that any human can know if they're correct. And in fact, this is in violation of the Help America Vote Act, which requires that all ballots, that voters be able to verify their ballot before it is cast and counted on any electronic voting system.
Well, the what is the purpose of this paper trail, the toilet paper roll that a voter can look at and say, oh, yeah, that's the vote I cast? What is the purpose of it if it doesn't have the legal weight of a ballot and therefore is not required to be counted in the event of a close, contested, or audited election?
Well, actually, the Holt bill does require that the paper trail be used in the event of a recount, in the event of an audit, after the election, after election night. As you recall, on in 2000, for example, George W. Bush was named the winner of the race on election night, and then went to all the way to the Supreme Court to say, hey, if you count those ballots, it will irreparably harm George Bush since he's already been announced the winner. That's why it's so important to get this right on election night, not in a later recount or in a later audit of a small 3% is what they're talking about of these paper trails. And the fact is, even if you go and audit those paper trails later on, MIT and Caltech have put out studies showing that people do not check their paper trails, or if they do, they're unable to spot errors and other problems like that. So you're going to end up auditing these so-called paper trails, which have either not been checked or have been checked but not accurately, and measuring them against the machine totals to give yourself, frankly, a fraudulent result in the audit. And we've seen that happen. We saw that they rigged the recount back in Ohio in 2004.
Yep.
And so the fact that the Democrats are now making this, frankly, as easy as ever in many cases, to have a fake recount, essentially, and yet walk away thinking that the result is real, is just extraordinary. And people, listeners here, need to stand up, they need to call their Congress member, and they need to demand a paper ballot that is actually counted for every vote cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll add to that, that there's been some extraordinarily deceptive tactics coming out from Congressman Rush Holt's office in cahoots with some of the groups that we usually appreciate their work, People for the American Way, most notably.
Mm-hmm.
But they've also been working with Common Cause and Move On and so forth to sort of sell this bill as the end of paperless electronic voting, which is a really deceptive way to put it because, yes, it will eventually end paperless electronic voting, but it will replace it with paper trail electronic voting, not with paper ballot voting. And that is equally deceptive because they also, in the bill itself, describe these paper trails as paper ballots. They're not ballots. They're certainly not ballots if they never get tabulated,
yeah,
either on election night or thereafter.
We're talking with Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. There's really just about a day remaining. We think that Wednesday is when this bill will come up on the floor of the House. So please get active and do it pronto. Call your member of the House. The Senate will not be voting on this in the immediate future. But pressure your House members to take a close look at H.R. 811, the Holt bill, and vote no when it comes to the House floor. Now, Brad, just a minute or two remaining. I wanted to ask you to explain to our listeners what vote caging is and what this means in respect to the U.S. attorney scandal and Karl Rove's involvement with U.S. attorneys. We have a case in the South now that is really gathering steam.
Yeah, and by the way, we may hear more about this this afternoon because we've got Brad Schlossman and Todd Graves from the Justice Department, one attorney who was pushed out, another one who was put in his place to bring phony voter fraud charges. They'll be having hearings this afternoon in the Senate. We'll try to cover them at bradblog.com. Essentially, what came out of Monica Goodling's testimony a week or so ago was information that they knew about this vote caging that was going on back in 2004, essentially sending registered letters from the Republican National Committee, sending these letters to voters in Florida in this case, which if they were not answered, then they would use that information to either get these voters purged from the rolls or challenged on Election Day. Now, of course, as Greg Palast discovered when he analyzed these caging lists that showed up in his mailbox back in 2004, he found out that the caging list had targeted what else? Minority voters, Democratic voters, in some cases, you know, black folks serving in Iraq, who of course weren't here to return their to return this registered letter, and they were challenged while they were over fighting ostensibly for democracy in Iraq. Their votes and their right to vote are being challenged back here. That's highly illegal. It's felonious. The Republicans agreed in a consent decree back in 86 to not do this, and yet now we have email from Tim Griffin, the right-hand man of Karl Rove, that this was done in 2004. John Conyers is taking a look at this in the House Judiciary Committee, says that he's not done with Tim Griffin yet, and Griffin was, until just last week, the U.S. attorney down there in Arkansas.
Yeah, he resigned.
He resigned after, as a matter of fact, Greg Palast reports, after Conyers had gone to the BBC to request these documents. It was the BBC who reported this information back in 2004. No one, virtually, in the American media, the mainstream media, picked it up. It's an extraordinary story, and this thing could very likely go straight up to the White House, along with the rest of this politicization of the Department of Justice, to push this phony idea of voter fraud, Democratic voter fraud, solely under the guise of shaving Democratic votes wherever and however they could. It's absolutely reprehensible, and, you know, someone needs to be held accountable here, because I believe that this thing goes straight up to the top, and certainly to Karl Rove, and probably to the White House itself.
And it appears to me that this is the reason that Alberto Gonzalez is hanging on, to try to keep the cover-up together. Brad Friedman, I want people to go to your website, bradblog.com. There's much more about both of these stories and a lot of other stories, too. Thanks for your work.
Hey, thanks, Peter. Let me real quick want to give the number to Congress, 202-225-3121. Call them. Tell them the Holt bill needs to be changed to require a paper ballot for every vote cast.
Got it. Thank you, Brad. Now to Drew in Eugene. Drew, you're on the Tom Hartman program, and I'm Peter B. Collins. Hello, Drew. Let's push the button here. Now you're on. Go ahead.
Anyway, I'm calling because the FCC guy you had on earlier, I think it's really annoying that we have people out there regulating what is said on television and using tax dollars to do so. I mean, if you can't control what goes into your kids' ear on television, that's a reflection on you as a parent. You should be making your kid sit down and do his homework before you expect me to run out there and like pay for you to have like this Leave It to Beaver television put out there just to dumb down our kids in the first place.
We want all Pleasantville all the time. I've got your comment. Thank you, Drew. Appreciate that. More of your calls coming up next here on the Tom Hartman program. Dial us up toll-free at 866-303-2270. Sitting in for Tom, I'm Peter B. Collins.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
It's the Tom Hartman Program, and I'm Peter B. Collins. Glad to be with you today. We're taking your phone calls. Toll free at 866-303-2270. We'll get some expert commentary on the sentence for Scooter Libby from a woman who accurately predicted 30 months, Elizabeth De La Vega. She's written a book it's called The U.S. versus George W. Bush et al., and it lays out the case for impeachment or other accountability for the misdeeds of Bush, Cheney, and the gang. She'll be joining us in the next 15 minutes or so to talk about the sentence, and we're also working to find out whether Scooter Libby will be freed on bail pending appeal. Let's take some calls now. Casey in Portland, thanks for joining us. You're on the Tom Hartman program. This is Peter B.
Well, thank you, Peter B. I'm glad you caught me before my cell phone died.
Oh, good.
A couple points I'd like to make, and I have no doubt Brad's coming from the highest ethical standard. However, some things should be noted. People supporting Holt worked real hard to try to get a DRE ban in, really hard.
Yeah.
They found the votes weren't there. So essentially the question is, you want all, you're going to get nothing. And this is a divisive issue in the election reform community itself. And
it is.
I hate to see the community divided. But it's not, the bill is not going to be marked up. It's not going to be changed. It's either going to be passed or dumped at this point. And I would encourage the people, before they start calling their legislators, to go take a look at the bill. It's got the paper. It ain't the paper we want. It's got audits. It's not necessarily audits we like, but it's a step in the right direction. Now, like I say, the election reform community is divided, and even my own group here in Oregon is divided
mm-hmm.
on it.
Well, Casey, I respect your position, but I respectfully disagree. I think that this is the last best chance, and that if we lay down and support it, that no attempts will be made to fix it. I realize the clock is running on 2008, but I think the Congress needs to reject this package and go back and do more work on it. And I understand your point that you don't think there are the votes there to ban DREs. Well, we need to do more education of the public to explain what happened in Sarasota, to explain what happened in other jurisdictions where these machines simply cannot be relied upon. We cannot outsource our election process, one of the most fundamental practices of our democracy, to companies that won't even share the source code with registrars of election. And there are other elements in this Holt bill, for example, that upend the historic requirement that ballot boxes be opened in front of a judge. This lets committees of the election officials do that, and that is an invitation to fraud of a different dimension. So I understand your position. I'm glad you called, but I respectfully believe that we need to reject the Holt bill in its present form. David in Santa Cruz, you've been holding for ages. Thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. This is Peter B.
Yeah, hi, Peter. It's David normally from San Francisco, and but down here today I'm sitting among the orchids and roses, and it's just a wonderful thing. I wanted to, you were talking about media coverage on various issues, and I had a couple of different examples. I told the screener I wanted to talk about the death of the senator in Senator Thomas in Wyoming.
Right.
And if I could give a second example before I did, you were talking also about the JFK terrorism bill.
Mm-hmm.
or the
news accounts, yeah.
Right. And it's funny, I read a newspaper article about this yesterday, and the headline was something like informant helps stop terrorism plot. But you could have rewritten the headline to be just as accurate by saying, informant gets lighter sentence by creating terrorism plan.
Well, we have a whole pattern of these. The Lodi Mosque, there's an informant there who got $250,000 to frame this father and son. We've got the case in Miami of the guys who were gathered together so their FBI informant could lead them in a loyalty pledge to Osama bin Laden. I mean, this is really gone amok. And
right.
the media rarely does the follow-up reporting. Take, for example, the liquid bomber plot from Britain a year and a half ago. We're all on lockdown at the airports. You can't even take a little tube of toothpaste or hair gel on an airliner or nasal spray for your sinuses because of a couple of Bojinka copycats in London. They originally arrested 25 people. More than half of those people have been released. The alleged mastermind of that has been downgraded to a schlub.
Sure.
And our whole airliner system is now bogged down with these new security regulations that don't make any sense and don't make us any safer.
Right. It's that if you give a paranoid a blank check and then you give them the ability to use top secrecy for that blank check, you've got an equation for massive looting of the country. And the issue I wanted to raise about Wyoming, there have been many Supreme Court rulings saying that the Constitution, which reads specifically the requirements for a U.S. senator are that they be over the age of 30 and that they reside in the state for 1 year. Simple as that. Now, when Senator Thomas died yesterday...
yesterday is right.
Right. The Democrat, the governor over there is a Democrat. Thomas was a Republican. The governor over there has no requirement to replace him with a Republican. He has no requirement. The simple requirement is, the, as the Constitution reads, he's going to replace him with somebody over the age of 30 and who is a citizen of that state for over 1 year. And no other requirement. The state actually cannot limit what the Constitution puts in. So the idea is, and the mass media in Wyoming is coming up with this hoax that the senator has to be replaced by a Republican.
That's just spin. That is pure spin. It's not founded. You're correct. The Constitution trumps any state law in that respect, and they simply are dreaming. Let me squeeze in Lee from Oregon. He's got a quick comment about the New York terror plot. Go ahead, Lee. Lee from Oregon on line 8. Let's see. There you go, Lee. Go right ahead. Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, when Bush planned and talked about bombing Al Jazeera, this was released in the media from the UK minutes of a meeting. What's the difference between Bush talking and planning about bombing and these guys at JFK talking and planning about it? They're both terrorist acts. Why are some in jail and the others not?
Well, I think ultimately Bush belongs in jail, but that's a whole other story. Lee, thank you for your call today. Thanks for all your calls. We'll continue after the break here on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Tom Hartman is in Dubrovnik in the former Yugoslavia, and he'll return live on this program on Thursday. I'm here today and tomorrow and Friday. And my name's Peter B. Collins. I'm based in San Francisco, where I host a West Coast progressive talk show. And you can find out more about me at peterbcollins.com. A little bit later this hour, I'm going to share a fun segment with you. It started with a voicemail when I was out at lunch last week. I came back, and a guy named Bradford Lemley left me a message inviting me to dinner with President Bush and a congressman from Oklahoma. And so I returned the call. And you're going to hear that a little bit later this hour as we pull back the curtains on the GOP's fundraising operation. And what's amazing is this occurred last Thursday, and on Friday, the Republicans fired the entire telemarketing crew. I'm not sure there's a connection, but the timing is very interesting. So that's a little later this hour. Right now joining us is Elizabeth De La Vega. She worked as a U.S. attorney, an assistant U.S. attorney in the San Jose office, the Northern District for California. She is the author of a powerful book called United States versus George W. Bush et al., which outlines cases for accountability for the president and his crew. Elizabeth De La Vega, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, Scooter Libby was sentenced to 30 months, and that was your precise prediction in a piece that you wrote for Tom Dispatch and also appeared yesterday at truthout.org. I've got the printout in front of me because sometimes, you know, that web stuff disappears.
Right, I know. No, and that was... I feel like I won the lottery.
Well, now, I called you an hour ago, and you said you had time to walk the dog. Did you take a victory lap?
And we did.
Were you on your laser scooter as you led the dog on that victory lap?
Well, it hasn't been been delivered yet. You told me I was going to win a scooter, but I haven't got it yet.
So you took a look at the sentencing guidelines and, you know, the case that had been presented, the four convictions that the jury returned against Lewis Libby, and you projected that Judge Reggie Walton would sentence him in the range of 30 months. He also tossed him a $250,000 fine, and the friends of Scooter will be able to pick up that tab just like a dinner at Jack Abramoff's restaurant. The key issue right now is, does Judge Walton believe that Libby should be free while his appeals are pending?
Right, and just based on what I was able to glean from reading the blog at Fire Dog Lake, they were live blogging it, mm-hmm. I got the sense that Judge Walton was not inclined to let the defendant be free pending appeal, but Wells, the lawyer for Libby, convinced him to let them at least file memos. So there's going to be another hearing in a week.
I see.
And if the judge rules against the defendant, I think it would be about 45 to 60 days before he would have to actually go to jail.
Mm-hmm. So no perp walk today?
No. And that would very rarely happen. They would have to find that the defendant posed an imminent danger to the community.
Or a threat of flight?
Right, a threat of flight, exactly. And neither one of those seemed to apply.
Mm-hmm.
But It was a very appropriate sentence, and I think that Judge Walton made it very clear that he considered this to be an extremely serious crime, and he wasn't persuaded at all by the many, many letters from notables, including Henry Kissinger, Douglas Feist, whom I would not want to have write a letter on my behalf.
Amen.
Wolfowitz would throw the letter. It was quite a who's who.
Wait a minute. Was Wolfie's letter on World Bank stationery?
I don't know, but one of the letter writers actually described Libby as an island of virtue in the White House.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
That's the post-Harriet Myers White House.
I don't know. Either way, it's not high praise. I don't know. It's just unbelievable.
Now, did Scooter bring any humility to the courtroom today?
Not at all. He made one of the shortest sentencing statements by a defendant I've ever heard, actually, in a case like this, a white-collar case. He basically just thanked all the court personnel, including the judge and the security guards, for being polite and kind to him during the trial. That's all he said.
Wow. I have a quote here at CNN.com. Libby spoke briefly. It is respectfully my hope that the court will consider, along with the jury verdict, my whole life.
Yeah, he did add that. He did say that, but that is about it.
So he didn't admit to any wrongdoing, and you and I discussed this recently, that one of the lingering issues that could have been on the sentencing judge's mind was that the Libby defense team put him through all kinds of hoops and steps that then became unnecessary because they were premised on Libby testifying in his own defense, which at the last minute they decided he would not do.
Right, and I think that would be just very small component, really, of the overall contempt for the charges that the defense showed. And I think that came through loudly and clearly in that sentencing memo.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Elizabeth, congratulations to you for your correct prediction. People can still probably go to truthout.org and find the column that you wrote with the prescient prediction. And I want to thank you for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
Good to talk with you. That's Elizabeth de la Vega, and her book, once again, is called U.S. versus George W. Bush et al. I'm Peter B. Collins here for Tom Hartman today. Lines are open if you'd like to comment on anything that's going on. I have very loose rules for caller participation. We like you to be coherent, but you can call and talk about any subject from any viewpoint from anywhere within the sound of my voice, and it's toll-free to boot at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. Anna in East Hampton, Mass., welcome to the Tom Hartman program today. This is Peter B.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing fine, thanks. I appreciate your call.
Let's see. I just was listening to the discussion about Senator Thomas's death and was checking it out on NewYorkTimes.com.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it was really hard to find the article. I wouldn't have known if I hadn't been listening to you. But at the bottom of the article it says, but under Wyoming law, the governor must choose from a list of three candidates put forward by the Republican State Central Committee. So I guess there is a law that they must have a Republican.
All right. Well, I have to put this out to any legal beagles who are listening who know more than I do about precedent here. But I believe that can be an advisory measure on the part of the lawmakers of the state of Wyoming. But I my deep belief, and I'm not a lawyer, and probably I'm just an opinionated guy, but my deep opinion is that the governor is not bound by that. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yep.
But I don't believe that a state can put those limitations on the appointment of a replacement senator. And if somebody can correct me, I'll be glad to take your call. You'll get right to the head of the line, so call us at 866-303-2270. Thank you, Anna. Now to let's go to Claire in Portland, Maine. Hello, Claire. Thanks for calling the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, hello. Thank you for speaking with me. I was inspired here a bit ago when I heard, I don't know if it was Randy or one of you all, mention that we needed to set up a special prosecutor to go towards dealing with Gonzalez and thereafter the whole crew. And, you know, I went and did the research yesterday to find out who it is that actually does make decisions to choose a special prosecutor. And, well, I found out it was Gonzalez, and I'm thinking, well, there's got to be somebody else. And I found out that the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, in fact, is the person that is typically to do such. But he's come into office at the same time as the rest of the administration. And my question is, who is his boss? How does anyone get him to do his job? I've got his job description here that I can read to you.
Well, read a brief line or two.
All right,
it's
only a couple of lines. It reads that the Office of the Inspector General conducts independent investigations, audits, inspections, and special reviews of the United States Department of Justice personnel and programs to detect and deter waste, fraud, abuse, and misconduct,
mm-hmm.
and to promote integrity and economy, efficiency, and effectiveness in the Department of Justice operations. Now, this person... And I haven't mentioned his name because it is available within
it's
the Google
Bruce,
system.
Bruce Fine.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I tried this morning just because I was questioning and thinking about who is his boss, and I don't know who his boss is.
It is a little murky because he's supposed to be independent of the political appointee,
right,
Alberto Gonzalez. At the same time, I believe Gonzalez controls his budget and so can ultimately cut off any investigation that he doesn't want to see go forward. But that's a very interesting question. And absent the extension of the special counsel law that expired during the Clinton administration, all we have is the Attorney General, or as he did in the case of Scooter Libby, he recused himself and permitted an underling to appoint Patrick Fitzgerald as a special counsel there. We'll continue in a moment on the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B. in San Francisco.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. Happy to be sitting in for Tom today, who is on assignment there in Dubrovnik in the former Yugoslavia. He'll be back live with you with a satellite broadcast on Thursday. But he's handed the reins to me for today, tomorrow, and Friday, and I couldn't be happier. We're taking your calls toll-free at 866-303-2270. Tonight, the Republicans will have a love fest in Manchester, New Hampshire. CNN will televise it. And if you can stand it, go ahead and watch. In a few minutes, we're going to pull back the curtain on the Republican fundraising operation, how they pander to small business owners and dangle tax cuts and a dinner with the president to try to squeeze bucks out of them. We'll pass that along to you in just a few. And also, just briefly, I am really wondering where this is going to go. But Bush and Vladimir Putin of Russia are really heating up the rhetoric in advance of the G8 summit. And just think what it's going to be like, because W invited Pootie to Kennebunkport for a pre-July 4th little mini vacation there on the Maine coastline. And those guys might be at each other's throats by then. Maybe they'll even throw up a missile defense system off the coast of Maine. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Lee in Brookville, Florida wants to join us and educate us a little bit about independent counsels and the Inspector General. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
Before, even though I live in Florida.
Well, I'm glad you called, even though you live in Florida.
The independent counsel law was started during the Nixon era.
That's right.
Not the special prosecutor law, the independent counsel law.
You are correct.
And then that was let to expire because of the abuses of Ken Starr and others during the Clinton administration.
Well, that's one reason.
Yeah.
They also were worried about Al Gore and the Buddhist nuns.
Oh, that's right.
Janet Reno was doing backflips to try to prevent appointing an independent counsel to investigate that, and ultimately she did not.
Well, no wonder. We probably still have that independent counsel still looking into it. I mean, take 20 years doing this. Anyway,
that's fair.
The special prosecutor came into play, Patrick Fitzgerald, when John Ashcroft was ill.
That's right.
His underling,
James Comey.
Yeah. Was a friend of Karl Rove, and they thought, oh, we'll just appoint a special prosecutor because we'll look like we're doing a really good thing here.
I'm not sure James Comey's a friend of Karl Rove anymore.
I don't think probably any of them are friends of each other anymore.
Yeah.
Except Monica Goodling, who seems to have gotten her pretty little blonde head off the hook there. So anyway, I keep hearing people say the special prosecutor law, and I keep thinking, no, it's the independent counsel law, and the whole thing was between when Nixon was in office mm-hmm. and when Clinton got out of office, then it ended.
Gotcha. And Lee, do you do crossword puzzles?
I used to do them all the time.
Okay, I just had a suspicion. Thanks for your call. Now to Drew in Monterey, who often puts up a good argument. Hey, Drew, welcome to the Tom Hartman program today. This is Peter B. Drew, are you there? Drew gave up. That's so disappointing. Gene in San Francisco, listening to 960 The Quake. Hello, Gene. You're on the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Peter. I really enjoyed your interview with Elizabeth de la Vega. I read her great book, George W. Bush et al.
Right.
And the comment I want to make is just short. You know, we talk a lot about how the Bushies lie and obfuscate and stonewall. I want us to enlarge our language the way Elizabeth de la Vega does. I want us to follow her lead. She labels it legally as fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to start talking about their fraud, because if I think if the American people start talking about their fraud, maybe we'll get a little closer to impeachment.
I agree. Language is very important, and lately the Democrats have simply been borrowing the framing and language of the Bush administration. That's one of the reasons why the supplemental gambit failed, and we're going to talk about that in the final hour today with Jeffrey Feldman, who is an expert on framing and rhetoric. Thank you for that call, Gene. I appreciate it. Now let's jump to the other coast. David in Portland, Maine, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Go right ahead, David.
Thank you very much, Peter. I really appreciate your taking over for Tom. I'm listening on my computer, and it's a wonderful program.
Well, thank you. This is what I love to do.
I have sort of a complex idea, and I was going to present it as simply as possible. Some of the segments that have come out on Air America seem to me to be so excellent and so exquisite and clear-focused. And I bring up the example of the Dennis Kucinich interview on Ring of Fire, talking about the hydrocarbon law.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that you could take that information and package it and send it through, say, MoveOn or through an organization that could get the emails from their constituents for all the state legislatures and send these by email using that kind of an interview
mm-hmm.
to try and make them aware? And the reason I bring it up is because I went to the impeach rally in Augusta, and there were two people that came outside from the legislature to actually listen to our presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me it's frustrating to know that inside there are all these good people working hard for the state of Maine, that many of them don't have access to either Democracy Now or to Air America Radio.
Well, maybe we should load up some iPods with some good programs like the ones you described and send them over to the members. Oh, then they'd have to report that on their disclosures. I don't know. We'll have to work on it, David, but you've got the germ of a good idea there. Maybe some other listeners can help move it forward. Give us a call toll-free, 866-303-2270. For Tom Hartman, I'm Peter B. Collins.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program rolls on. And I'm Peter B. Collins from San Francisco, sitting in for Tom today, tomorrow, and Friday this week. Your calls and comments are welcome at 866-303-2270. That's toll-free, 866-303-2270. More of your calls coming up in just a moment. But as promised, I want to pull back the curtain here on the slick fundraising operations of the Republican Party. They've done very well over the years, and part of it is that they know how to pander to a certain target. And what you're going to hear is targeted telemarketing. It starts with a voicemail message from a guy who claims to be Bradford Limley. When we ask about him a little later on, we're not sure that's his real name. Then when I return the phone call, first there is the person who fields the call. She's friendly. She qualifies me, so you have the qualifier. Then there's the pitch pre-recorded from the congressman. And then the closer comes on the line. So let's listen how the Republicans raise money from unsuspecting citizens in the United States.
This message is for Mr. Peter Collins. Mr. Collins, my name is Bradford Limley, and I'm your contact with the Business Advisory Council. Congressman Tom Call would like to invite you to dinner with President Bush on June 13th. Please call me as soon as you get this message at 1-888-383-8065. Thank you.
Now, maybe in my excitement, I overstated. Maybe it's not actually dinner at the White House. Maybe it's at a White Castle. I don't know. Let's see what happens when I return the call here. This is unrehearsed. I have no idea if this is the Republican National Committee or, a boiler room at Kennebunkport, Maine. I just don't know.
Thank you for calling the Business Advisory Council,
mm-hmm.
a project of the National Republican.
Oh.
Hello, and thank you for calling the NRCC's Business Advisory Council. This is Shirley Thompson, and how may I help you?
Shirley, I'm returning a call from Bradford Limley. This is Peter B. Collins, and I'm calling from my job.
All right, just one moment.
Okay.
It's Mr. Collins?
That's right. Yeah, you can call me Peter.
Okay.
I save that Mr. stuff for the arresting officer and the sentencing judge.
Okay. Peter Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S?
Yeah, I'm wondering how I got on the list of the Business Advisory Council.
Well, we do have a listing of small business leaders in each state, and your name was chosen from that list.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I feel special.
Well, yeah, it is quite an honor. Bradley isn't available at the moment. I'd be more than happy to help you and just
okay.
let me find your message.
Now, is his name Bradley or Bradford? He told me that his name was Bradford Limley.
Oh, you're probably right. I call him Brad.
I see.
Okay. I apologize.
And where are you located, in India or the Philippines?
Ohio.
Oh, in Ohio?
Yes.
I'm from Ohio.
Oh, really?
I grew up in Cincinnati.
Oh, okay. Well, you're at one end of the state and I'm at the other.
You must be in Cleveland.
Up near Cleveland, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes.
And what's it like there today?
It was in the 90s.
Oh, my.
You're calling from San Rafael?
Yeah. Yeah, San Francisco area. Mm-hmm.
All right. Great. I do have a message here for you. I'm glad you called.
Now, it's something about dinner with the president on June 13th.
Yes.
And where is the... Is it at the White House or at a White Castle?
Well, at the White House, let me explain. Again, my name's Shirley Thompson. I work with Congressman Tom Cole at the National Republican Congressional Committee in Washington.
Uh-huh.
I know you're busy, and I'll be brief. The congressman asked us to call you because he's looking to bring business leaders closer to the Republican leaders in the House.
Uh-huh.
He'd like your input on crucial issues like taxes, small business legislation, and the minimum wage increases.
Uh-huh.
And he'd also like you to come to Washington for dinner with the president.
Okay.
Let me play a brief message he's recorded for you, then I can answer any questions afterwards.
Surely this is high tech.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Thank you. Here's the congressman.
Okay. This is special, isn't it?
Hi, this is Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma.
Yo, Tom.
Chairman of the National Republican Congressional
Committee. Hey, let's cut taxes. What do you say?
Businessman.
Let's lower wages after we cut taxes. Then we can cut pensions and, you know, cut into some health benefits. What do you say, Tom?
You're a visionary. You play a critical role in your local economy by providing jobs.
Oh, come on. Kiss up to me, please.
Services. The government should be thanking you on a daily basis for all that you do.
Yeah.
It's almost inconceivable, but some of our elected officials actually think you're part of the problem. They think you're rich and your wealth should be redistributed to people they feel are more deserving.
Uh-huh.
The new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, is one of those elected officials. And now that she and the Democrats are in charge of Congress, business people like you have a bullseye on your back.
Oh, I feel it.
Democrats have only been in power a few months.
Pelosi's a great shot.
They've already proposed the largest tax increase in American history. And guess who they want to pay for it? We learned in the last election that we cannot take our Republican majority for granted, especially when you consider we could have a Democrat in the White House next year. And that's why I'm asking you to join the Business Advisory Council. I need your input and your expertise, so please stay on the line and my assistant will fill you in. Thanks.
Okay, Tom, that was beautiful. He said all the right things, didn't he?
Hi, Mr. Collins.
Just what I wanted to hear. Hello.
Were you able to hear the message?
Oh, I lost Shirley. I was talking to Shirley Thompson there.
Oh, okay. She had another call, sir. I'm sorry. My name's John Ambrose. Were you able to hear the message?
Oh, hi, John. Sure.
Great.
Yeah, I mean, he wants to cut taxes, and, you know, I got a bullseye on my back, and Nancy Pelosi's pulling the bow right back and ready to fire away. I'm scared.
Exactly. Now, as a member, you'll receive the official congressional gavel display in your office.
Oh, gavel?
And naturally, you'll be invited to the President's Dinner in Washington.
Yeah. Where is that? I have it on June 13th, but where are we going to dine?
Sir, once people confirm and join the council, then we'll notify you. The event's held in downtown Washington, sir.
Oh, okay. I was hoping maybe at Cheney's house.
No, sir.
No?
Or you can also make contact with some of the top business leaders in America.
Mm-hmm.
As a member of the Business Advisory Council, we need your input on the issues that affect your business the most.
Right.
It gives business leaders like you a real working relationship with Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, we need input from people like you who have some real business sense.
Yeah.
In our first order of business, support a series of small business tax cuts, allowing you to reinvest back into your business.
Right.
With your permission, we'd like to list your name in a full-page Wall Street Journal ad and send you a full-size copy to show your friends and family.
Uh-huh.
We think your name will really give us a boost there in California. Mr. Collins, we both know that Nancy Pelosi is going to finance her liberal agenda by taking away more of your hard-earned money. So we've got to nip this in the bud right now.
Now, that's a little dangerous language there. You talk about a wonderful woman like Nancy Pelosi and you want to nip her in the bud?
Bud, B-U-D, sir.
Oh, I see. Okay. Language is everything.
Right.
Now, John, what is the cost of entree here for me to join the Business Advisory Council?
Well, there's no cost to serve on a Business Advisory Council.
Really?
We do ask people to help us co-sponsor our...
I don't have to be like a pioneer or a ranger or a double ranger or something like that?
No, sir, you just have to be yourself.
Uh-huh. Well, that's not always easy for me.
Right. We're asking people to help co-sponsor this urgent media campaign with a one-time contribution of $500 or $600, which we can split into two payments. The ad's almost ready to go to press. And if we're successful, you could save thousands and thousands of dollars. So can we add your name?
No. No, I don't like to, because I'm not exactly sure how you're going to use it. And so I'm not prepared to authorize that at this time.
A lot of money that we use to help us get elected back in the House, more pro-business congressmen, to regain control of the House, obviously, sir.
Yeah, I don't think that's really in the best interest of the country. I like a two-party system, and I really feel a one-party rule has been bad in Washington, you know, for the Republicans and, you know, in other states where the Democrats have full control. So I really like the tension, you know, of two-party rule. So I'm not really interested right now in seeing the Republicans get back in control of the House or the Senate. How do you feel about that?
So what you're saying, sir, if Democrats get, you don't want a Democrat in presidency either, then?
Well, I'm open to that. I mean, honestly...
You don't want them having anybody party having control of everything, sir.
Right.
If they have control of the House and Senate, then you'd be wanting a Republican... in a presidency or vice versa, if a Democrat became president, you want to see the Republicans in control of the House and Senate then.
Yeah, I see your point.
What your statement was.
Right. Yeah. I guess the problem is that Bush has screwed things up so badly. You know, I mean, he's the biggest spender in history. This war is a mess. And it's, you know, if I got a chance to talk to him at dinner, I'd probably pull him aside and whisper a few things in his ear. Because, you know, Gonzalez is a disgrace, a real embarrassment, and he should have pulled the ripcord on that guy months ago. Hello, John?
Oh, I'm waiting. I don't know if you're finished, sir, because yeah. You usually go keep talking and everything, so I was just finding out if you were done. Obviously, sir, it sounds like you're a Democrat, and this is something you're not interested in. I want to thank you for your time.
Uh-huh.
This call is paid for by the NRCC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. Our website's nrcc.org, and you have a great day.
All right, John, thanks. So that was John Ambrose at the Republican National Congressional Campaign Committee, and that was on Thursday of last week.
Thank you very much.
On Friday, he and everybody else in the telemarketing operation were let go.
Here we go, starting another war. We got our heads up our asses. You know, we're really bored. Hey, hey, we're the Republicans. And people say we act like clowns. We love natural disasters. Did somebody really drown? We lie whenever we want to. Yeah, you know it's true. And if you don't believe us, turn on the nightly news. Hey, hey, we're the Republicans, and people say we act like clowns.
So if they fired their entire telemarketing team, what will the Republicans do next? Well, we've dispatched my own personal, in-depth, undercover, low-budget investigative reporter, Tommy Panic, to investigate that. And he promises a report in the next hour sometime, so stand by. We'll bring you that when we can. In the meantime, we'll take a break and return for more of your phone calls at 866-303-2270. That's toll-free, 866-303-2270. Also, still to come on the Tom Hartman program today, Jeffrey Feldman will join us. He's written a book called Framing the Debate. He runs the website frameshopisopen.com, and he's going to offer us some commentary on how language and rhetoric and the framing of the debate affect the outcome, particularly on the struggle over the funding for the continuing occupation of Iraq, where the Democrats did cave in the recent struggle. So that's ahead. If you'd like to drop me an email, my personal email address is peter@peterbcollins.com. And at that website, in the next day or so, we will post an audio clip, a podcast of our phone call to the Republican National Congressional Campaign Committee, or whatever that's called, the Business Advisory Council. And so you can listen to it again and maybe pass it around to your friends, as our caller suggested a couple of minutes ago up in Maine, that sometimes you need fodder to try to persuade people, and gosh, that just might be one example of that. So feel free to drop by my website, www.peterbcollins.com, and we'll have that clip up for you in the next day or so. You can also drop in there to catch archives of my program. This is Peter B. sitting in for Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. My thanks to Chris Lopresto and Lauren Kirchner in New York for keeping the operation running smoothly here. And I want to thank people for calling and holding on. How about Quinn in Sunnyvale, California, listening to 960 The Quake? Welcome, Quinn. You're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Collins, for taking my call.
Oh, I hate it when you say that, Quinn. You were on hold for 35 minutes. Thank you for participating and spending a half an hour to get on the air and talk.
Well, it's worth it.
Okay,
I was
good.
Just calling. I'm a student here in the Bay Area, just about turning 20, and the first two elections that I can really remember and actually, you know, wanted to participate in were both, you know, effectively stolen, both through either voter fraud or through the Supreme Court. And
just
the
technical, wait, not voter fraud, but election fraud.
Thank you.
All right, there's very little evidence that voters have committed fraud on any meaningful scale.
Yes, that's exactly what I meant, was election fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember actually when I was a senior in high school in 2004, just knowing when I saw those electronic voting machines coming up that nothing good could have come of that. But really, I think what the Republicans have done more in a sense than steal two elections is they've created, and it may be intentional, a great sense of apathy from many students my age and a little bit younger and a little bit older, because all we have seen is elections that have really been taken away from us.
Yeah.
And I'd just like to say, though, that, you know, shows like this and shows like Tom Hartman's that really help us get energized and activated and motivated to go out there and continue to want to vote and to participate in democracy.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I appreciate your interest. Unfortunately, I think too many people your age are, just watching American Idol and kind of checking out instead of really paying attention to these critical issues. Thanks for the call, Quinn. Now to Jeff in Denver. Thanks for holding, Jeff. You're on the air on the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Peter. As a election hyperactivist, I want to say that before I talk about the VVPATs and Diebold felonies, the most important thing that we have to look at, and this is very important when looking at the Rush Holt bill, it's not about recounts, it's not about audits, it's about how we count the vote to begin with. And that's what we keep on neglecting in this legislation. And with the VVPATs in Ohio, Election Science Institute, which is electionscience.org, they did the study of the VVPATs in Ohio and found that there was about a 10% of them had problems.
Voter verified paper trail is what you're referring to, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you look at electionscience.org, they have photos of them. Well, I like what you said, calling them toilet paper rolls. Try mm-hmm. to count a bunch of cash register tapes.
Yeah.
You know, and if you saw, I mean.
Well, but Jeff, the thing is that under the law, they are not considered to be ballots with the same legal weight as one that you filled out personally.
Yes, and so what we need is a paper ballot that is the official record of the election to begin with. It's not about recounts. Everything in the system is set up to prevent recounts.
Mm-hmm.
But look how often recounts happen when they're real problems. Rarely.
We also need some media restraint so that on election night, they don't feel compelled to give us a result that's based on flawed information.
Exactly.
And we need to be patient. I mean, after all, in 2000, we all sat still for, 7 or 8 weeks waiting for the outcome of the presidential race. I didn't like the way it was fixed by the Supreme Court, but we can wait. We do not have to have results instantly on election night. Thanks for your call, Jeff. Marty in Los Angeles is next. Hello, Marty. You're on the Tom Hartman program.
Hi. I wanted to give you my take on where I think both the Republican and Democratic nominations are going. The media doesn't seem to really go into much depth. I think among the Democrats, I think in 2006, with the election of people like John Tester and Jim Webb, the Democrats showed sort of a pragmatic side.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that that comes into 2008, because it'll give you a couple states that are in play, I think, if John Edwards is the nominee: Arizona, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, Missouri, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Those states would not be in play if Hillary Clinton is the nominee. So then
hold on, Marty. The one weak part of your calculus there is that John Edwards didn't carry North Carolina when he was on the Kerry ticket.
But again, he was second on the Kerry ticket. And people in North Carolina are probably not going to vote for a senator from Massachusetts. So I don't think that's a fair comparison.
All right. I think it's an open question, though, and John Edwards has to prove that he can carry one or more southern states, Florida and North Carolina, most notable.
Yeah. And amongst the Republicans, I think that there's no way that Giuliani will be the nominee, because that party will not have somebody that isn't anti-abortion. McCain is totally disliked by the party hierarchy. And Romney is sort of a Johnny-come-lately to their cause. So I think their nominee is probably going to be Fred Thompson. And if it comes down to Fred Thompson and Hillary Clinton, here we go again. And, you know, 42 states will go into their category, and here we go again in Florida and Ohio and Iowa and New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that someone like Edwards, and you mentioned North Carolina, but what about places like Colorado and Montana and Nevada? I don't think Hillary's got any kind of a shot in those places. And they're small states, don't have a whole lot of electoral votes, but you saw how close the elections have been, assuming
right.
they're on the up and up.
Yeah.
And I think Edwards has a chance, because Hillary is sort of a uniter of the Republican Party. And Edwards...
Good line.
Well, but no, it's not really a line. It's the truth. And you know, that's pretty much where I think... I want to say that piece you just played was fascinating on the Republican fundraising. And
glad you enjoyed it, Marty. The music's coming. I got to play us out here. Thanks for your call today. And we'll take more calls next hour. Grab a line, toll free at 866-303-2270. Tommy Panic will update us on the Republican fundraising operation, what they'll do next. So stay listening to the Tom Hartman program. I'm Peter B.
This- This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome to another hour of the Tom Hartman Program, Coast to Coast on Air America Radio. I'm Peter B. Collins from San Francisco, sitting in for Tom today and tomorrow and again on Friday. He'll be back live with you on Thursday at the usual times, live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. That's part of the former Yugoslavia on the beautiful Adriatic Sea. And he is there for a conference. You'll hear more about it on Thursday as he originates live by satellite from there. In the meantime, we're holding down the fort here, so to speak. I'm in San Francisco, and we've got callers lined up from all across the nation. We'll get to your calls here in just a moment. People are reacting, though, to the telephone call we played last hour as I returned a phone call inviting me to dinner with President Bush if I just joined the Republicans' Business Advisory Council. And Ed from Statesboro, Georgia, emailed. He said, Peter, they've been doing this for years. A couple of years ago, I received calls from these guys offering me to be an honorary chairman of the Business Advisory Council. It was a pretty slick production, complete with recordings from Tom DeLay. Oh, I feel cheated. I got Tom Cole, and you got Tom DeLay? I, being a member of the State Democratic Committee, says Ed, wasn't interested. Well, I was mainly interested to understand their tactics, and I think it was revealing to follow through there and see how they do it. I had one caller on the line who was a little offended by my call to the Republican National Committee. Her name was Jenna, but she didn't hold. What can I do? So what's the future of the GOP fundraising operation? They sacked the entire telemarketing team on Friday, and I'm not claiming that I am responsible, but I'm happy to pass that information along to you. We turn now to my own personal in-depth, undercover, low-budget investigative reporter, Tommy Panic. We put him on the case. Tommy, what have you learned about the fundraising plans of the Republican Party?
Well, I got one word for you, Peter. Outsourcing.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and I'm actually down here in Venezuela.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, I'm in Caracas. Not the easiest place to get to if you're on the no-fly list.
Right.
Where I wound up following my reporting on number 43's brand of fun prior to becoming a fake Christian and running for president. But nonetheless, here in the Venezuelan capital, now you know the story about the protests that continue down here following the refusal by the government to renew the broadcasting license of RCTV, Radio Caracas Televisión.
That's right.
There's still thousands of protesters down here marching both against and even in support of the government's decision. So you've got National Guard, you've got police that remain on the streets in the event that the violence continues. So if you do hear any gunshots during this report,
okay,
that's most likely the cause. Although it could be the Blackwater operatives that seem to pick up my tail anytime I ship myself to Central or South America. But anyway, based on the incident you were involved in, this is really interesting. The RNC needed to act fast to restaff not just the call center you spoke with, but all of them throughout North America. And that's where the outsourcing comes in. And you might think any sort of outsourcing for such a task would head to the Philippines or maybe India.
Right, yeah.
You know, and if not there, certainly China, who already owns this. And they'll soon see the majority of this work as their infrastructure improves. But for this task, a little closer to home, the job surprisingly goes to Venezuela, the country I'm standing in. The administration outsources our torture to countries that aren't supposed to be our friends.
Right, yeah.
Why not the fundraising of the RNC?
Now, is there some sort of secret admiration on the part of the Bush administration for the way Chavez has cracked down and made the media march to his tune there in Venezuela?
That's a good question. I mean, the Chavez reaction, well, first of all, the Bush reaction, it's interesting. They're our perceived enemy, but sources that I talk to tell me that our president is really starting to like this Hugo Chavez.
Really?
He called him the devil, but the brilliance of shutting down a TV network is truly thought-provoking for our guy.
Yeah.
So CNN, shows like yours, you probably want to look out. But it's interesting. I'm standing outside a very nondescript-looking eight-story office building in downtown Caracas where the training of those who will be fielding the calls and asking for the cash is nearly complete. So every operator is armed with a fake Southern accent. And remember, you got to sound like a hillbilly to be elected in America. And they derive these accents from listening to the American president. And the operators are also ordered to use key phrases in their pitch, such as tax hikes, brown people, fight them over there, or on your front lawn. And the beauty of that is that it works for both terrorism and immigration.
Yeah.
Also, keywords, the outsourcing of jobs. Little irony there. But the righties realized that their previous pitches, kind of like the one you heard, Peter, it sounded a little too much like they were intended for folks with room temperature IQs and low self-esteem. And, of course, that is not America. But, yeah, I mean, you might wonder about the Chavez reaction to this arrangement. That's what I was most interested in, the RNC and their efforts to bilk honest Americans out of their ever-dwindling paychecks. And as far as Chavez is concerned, as long as he gets his cut, it's all good.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, I mean, the next time you receive a phone call from someone with a North American Southern accent, probably not coming from a guy named Cletus in Armadillo, Texas, but I got to run. I will attempt to infiltrate the call center, and if successful, you, Peter, will be the first one to know.
I can't wait. Thank you, Tommy Panic.
Thank you.
That's our Panic update for today. Tommy Panic, our low-budget undercover investigative reporter, right there from Caracas, Venezuela. And I'm laughing and crying at the same time because he's going to send me the bill for shipping himself to Caracas. Let's take more of your phone calls. Julie in Sacramento on line 7. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program. This is Peter B.
Hi, Peter B.
Hello, Julie.
Hi. Just listening to that, I just wanted to mention on the call that you just made.
Yeah.
The different tones in the voices. One was a male that was nondescript, and then the female, and then the real deep voice.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that?
The closer?
Yeah, the closer was, reminds me of a gangster. But I have a question on immigration.
Yes, you mean amnesty?
No. My question is, does this apply to everybody? Everybody coming in from Europe, from Asia, they're going to have to work their way through the fields and then go back home and ask for their citizenship papers?
Of course not. As you know, one of the largest contributors to illegal immigration in this country is people who fly into our airports on tourist visas and never leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know to what extent this new bill does change the rules for immigration that is not farm workers from Central America or Mexico or South America. But, I think that is an issue that we're going to see for quite some time. Here's an email that just came in from Tom Tancredo. He is loading his armor and ready to lock and load for tonight's Republican Love Fest that CNN will broadcast from Manchester, New Hampshire. And Tom Tancredo has announced his Save America campaign. He is promising to oust senators who support the McCain-Kennedy-Bush amnesty bill. So amnesty is the code word here, Julie, that we're supposed to all respond to. And, of course, they want amnesty for Scooter Libby right now, and they're willing to support a presidential pardon for that. But no amnesty for people who come here attracted by our economic system and the opportunity to work, and who, for the most part, play by the rules and would come out of the shadows if we permitted it. Julie, thanks for your call from Sacramento today, listening to 1240 KSAC. And let's see, we've got Dave and Eureka on the line. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Peter. Excellent program. My question for you is, a lot of people that know Rush Holt, the congressman, believe that he's trying, honestly, to solve the problem. If his bill has gone as badly as everybody says it has, I'm wondering if he couldn't be persuaded to turn against his own bill. Do you know how it got so bad? Have people been in there tampering with it, or did he design it wrong from the get-go?
Well, from what I hear from different people who've been involved is there is consensus that they don't believe there are enough votes to ban the touchscreen voting machines. I would like to see them attempt it and even lose a committee vote on that before we take that as gospel. But fundamentally, I think that there is a lack of adequate education about the danger of our voting system, and in particular the hackable DRE machines. And part of that is driven by, I've even heard Democrats say, we don't want to talk about that. It'll discourage people from voting. Well, hey, stolen elections really discourage people from voting. And if we don't have confidence in the system, in the technology that's used, then that's going to be a major problem confronting us as we go forward. So I don't know the inner mechanics of what happened in the committee, Dave, but I do know that the bill that is poised to come on the floor tomorrow is deeply flawed and should not be passed in its current form. Thanks for your call today. We'll take more calls coming up right after a break. So lines are open for you toll-free at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. My email is peter@peterbcollins.com. And this is Peter B. sitting in for Tom Hartman today.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I caught you singing along with that one. That's a great tune from The Who, I Can See for Miles. This is the Tom Hartman Program, coast to coast on Air America Radio. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. Good to be with you today. And we go next to Ralph in Colorado Springs. Hello, Ralph. Thanks for calling in.
Hello, Peter. Congratulations on being a small business leader thanked by the Bush administration.
It really made me feel great that they wanted to pander to me and imagine that I want tax cuts and that I'm opposed to a minimum wage increase. It just, you know, brought out the inner Republican.
Well, I want to thank you, too, but for a bunch of different things.
Okay, just before you go there, I want to acknowledge an email from Roger here. Thanks for returning the call to the RNC. I got one of those calls years ago, an offer to meet with Cheney. I made a long story short, but assuming they wanted my money, they wouldn't really be listening to my opinions. He said, I didn't do what you did, so thanks. Anyway, I appreciate that note, Roger. Go ahead there.
Yeah, you'd asked a question. Is it a senator in Wyoming that died?
Yeah, Senator Craig.
Okay, yeah. It's actually covered by, not in the Constitution itself, but in the 17th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically provides, I'm going to paraphrase here, that the state legislatures can empower their governor to appoint a temporary senator until the people elect a new senator. And I would assume that when the state is given that power,
mm-hmm.
they can also put conditions on who they can appoint. Now, let me give you another bummer.
Well, I understand your analysis, and I just don't know if it's legally accurate, because my assumption is that the federal, the constitutional amendment trumps the state law. And I have to imagine that that state law was enacted by Republicans.
Well, I think that's clear. And like I say, we're never going to know for sure, sort of like the Florida election,
mm-hmm.
until we have the Supreme Court make a decision. Can I give you a second bummer here, just real quick?
Sure. Bum me all out. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is a bad one for you, because you had Elizabeth de la Vega on. And this is on the Libri potential pardon.
Mm-hmm.
Here is my scenario, hope it doesn't happen, for the last day of Bush's administration. He legally pardons, full, absolute, and complete pardon to everyone in his administration, including Libby and Cheney.
Yeah.
Bush resigns. Cheney is sworn in. Cheney, new president, now pardons Bush.
Oh.
Full, complete, and absolute pardon. No Bushy goes to jail unless Libby goes to jail between now and when he gets his pardon.
Yeah.
Happy Monday or Tuesday or whatever it is.
Okay, thank you, Ralph. And by the way, I truncated the name. It was Senator Craig Thomas of Wyoming who died, and I just called him Craig because I didn't know him that well. I had read about him here and there, but just didn't know much about what his contributions were or lack thereof. Let's go to San Diego next. Karen is listening on KLSD. Hello, Karen. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B.
Hi. It's been a long time.
Well, great. Thanks for calling.
I talked to you from Morgan Hill last year about some of the food policies that are going on.
Okay, I remember now, Karen, sure.
Well, since that time, the dark stuff is really hitting the fan. And one of the things that I'd like to talk about is the fact that if you keep a population sick, feeding them food, and you label them, which is about ready to happen, and you take down the state's own rights to force regulation and labels, then, you know, you can keep them too sick to really get involved in anything else.
And
what's happening right now is that the House Agriculture Committee is actually considering language in a farm bill that would deny states rights to protect citizens from risky foods, with the primary intent being to deny the state rights to regulate genetically engineered crops or foods.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people that I've spoken to really are under the impression that this is some kind of hybridization or gene splicing, which is really not the case. And on top of that, now there's actually a campaign expiration date of the 25th of this month. And I do have the toll-free Congress number, if I can give that.
Go right ahead, Karen.
Okay, it's 888-851-1879. And again, that's toll-free, 888-851-1879.
And I'm going to give the switchboard number because it's interesting. Different affinity groups set up these toll-free lines to call Congress, but they're not necessarily there permanently. So if you want to spend your own dime, it's 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121. Go ahead, Karen.
Okay, well, and I thought you might be also interested in a response I got from Senator Feinstein, who I got this on the 30th of May, and she wanted to thank me for expressing my support for the Cloned Food Labeling Act, which is S-414, because on December 28, 2006, the FDA announced that the meat and milk from clones of cattle, adult cattle, pigs, and goats, and their offspring are as safe to eat as food from conventionally bred animals.
Doesn't that make you feel really good?
Pardon?
I say, doesn't that make you feel really secure and good?
It makes me feel really manure, is actually what it makes.
Well, Karen, you raise a bunch of important issues here. We're running out of time in this segment, but is there a website? Oh, she's gone now. Anyway, there are a lot of critical issues related to food labeling, the introduction of genetically modified organisms into our food chain, and I am concerned about the progress of the Farm Bill in Washington right now, so watch that carefully, will you please? We're going to take a break and return. Jeffrey Feldman from FrameShopIsOpen.com will join us next here on the Tom Hartman Program. From San Francisco, I'm Peter B. Collins.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's 34 minutes past the hour, as I hear on Air America Radio. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom today and tomorrow and Friday, too. Tom will be back with you live from Dubrovnik, Croatia, on Thursday with a live satellite broadcast from the former Yugoslavia. And we're taking more of your calls in a moment at wrong toll-free number, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. And this just came in the last few minutes by email, a statement from Ambassador Joe Wilson regarding today's sentencing of Scooter Libby. If you missed it, he was sentenced to 30 months in prison and a $250,000 fine. Still to be determined when he actually reports for his sentence. The judge called for another hearing next week to discuss that. And this statement from Joe Wilson. As Americans, both Valerie and I are grateful that justice has been served, reconfirming that our country remains a nation of laws. We're also saddened for the pain that Mr. Libby has inflicted on his family, friends, and the nation. Mr. Libby benefited from the best this country had to offer, the finest schools, a lucrative career as a lawyer, many years of service in Republican administrations. That he would knowingly lie, perjure himself, and obstruct a legitimate criminal investigation is incomprehensible. It is our hope now that he will cooperate with Special Counsel Fitzgerald in his efforts to get to the truth. As Mr. Fitzgerald has said, a cloud remains over the Vice President. Every official in this administration must be held accountable for their actions. That's a quote and a statement from former Ambassador Joe Wilson. Joining me now is Jeffrey Feldman. His new book is out. I hope you'll pick it up, called Framing the Debate, with a dangerously long subtitle, Famous Presidential Speeches and How Progressives Can Use Them to Change the Conversation and Win Elections. He also publishes regularly at his website, FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey, welcome to the program today.
Hi, Peter.
Good to talk with you. I wanted to chew over a piece that you posted after what is widely viewed as a Democratic cave-in, or at least a legislative loss, on the supplemental for the occupation of Iraq. Just before Memorial Day, the Democrats sent through a pretty clean bill, as the president had demanded, and many people who felt that they had elected Democrats to end the occupation of Iraq and bring our troops home are bitterly disappointed. And in a piece that you called The Double Bind, you explore a couple of different angles here, and you don't regard this, at least in general terms, as a loss. Please explain.
Well, I should say that this piece caused quite a bit of stir when I put it up there. But the basic argument that I'm making in that piece is that the war in Iraq, the occupation in its current state, is really an expression of the failures of the Bush administration at this point. And it's not just a failure in terms of policy, but I make the argument that what the Bush administration has done during its tenure has really weakened a vital part of our governmental system, the separation of powers. The separation of powers is not just, you know, a neat idea that the framers put in the Constitution. It's the very basis by which our government retains its strength and perpetuates its ability to function efficiently and to function well. So when the Bush administration weakened it through such acts as, you know, the Patriot Act, and through essentially co-opting the entire legislative process by rendering the Congress ineffective, then they began a process of essentially shutting down the effectiveness of our government. So the problem we face now, after we elected the Democratic Congress, is not just passing one bill in order to stop the policy, but we need to revamp, to start up again the process in the Congress itself, to send bill after bill after bill. And when the process is up and running again, then there'll be enough power in the Congress in order to turn the policy around.
Well, I understand that point, and I think if we recall just a couple of months ago, there was an exchange mostly via television between the White House and the Speaker. And to her credit, Pelosi was calm, cool, and collected. And she said, "Take a deep breath, Mr. President." And she politely lectured him on the very point you're making, the separation of powers, and that there's a new Congress that is not a rubber stamp, that is not going to issue blank checks and just roll over for the White House. So I think that point was made, but your argument appears to be that the Democrats didn't sustain that line of argument.
Yeah, the Democrats, unfortunately, as happens a lot in Washington, they forget the importance of explaining to the American people exactly what they're going about doing. I think the Democrats had a really clear line of argumentation. They're concerned, perhaps wrongly, but nonetheless concerned about showing themselves as not, quote-unquote, funding the troops, this myth that if they don't pass a supplemental bill, suddenly the troops will have absolutely nothing, which, of course, is not true. Nonetheless, they were concerned about that, and they really do believe that in the long haul, they don't have enough votes to really stop the president's policy. So with each one of these bills, what they are trying to do is slowly build a larger and larger majority on the hopes that they can pass more and more effective and powerful legislation each time and bring the policy to a halt, a change, bring the soldiers home, and so forth.
Well, and when the president's veto became clear and when he actually carried out the threat, the Democrats did have a plan B, which I imagine there were not enough votes for in the Democratic caucus, but it was Murtha's idea, which I have embraced, for essentially giving Bush an allowance and saying, you know, you got to make this last and come back. And as we know, all appropriations bills must originate in the House. And while they can be augmented and massaged a little bit by the Senate, the ultimate bill that originates from the House, you know, can't double or triple. And so if the Democrats in the House, where they do have a margin of control, had put forth a series of bills with time restrictions or just with limited funds, it would have forced the president to keep coming back. Why did they abandon that, Jeffrey?
Well, I think, again, there's a growing fear in the Congress just before the Memorial Day break that anything that didn't look like 100% financial support for our soldiers in the field would open the Democrats, both in the House and in the Senate, up to the criticism that they did not really support the soldiers. And I think that fear kind of took hold, and at the time that the Democratic Congress became concerned about was not the timeline in the bill being sent to the president, but the amount of time they had left in order to show that they were indeed supporting the troops. And you hear that echoed just the other day in what Joe Biden was saying in the last kind of Democratic performance up in New Hampshire, in which he said that under no conditions would he sign anything that in any vague way even suggested that the Democrats didn't support the soldiers. So I think that fear got the best of him.
Well, and that is consistent with what Bill Maher said on his final episode of HBO this season, which is, and I have to clean it up a little bit for family radio here, the Democrats were afraid of being called wusses. And so they flinched, they blinked, at a time when they were actually starting to gain some leverage, or at least could have, in this struggle with the White House.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that the Democrats, I don't think this is the last time that Democrats in Congress are going to blink, because I don't believe that the Congress really feels its own power and credibility quite yet at this stage, which was part of the argument that I'm trying to make in that piece, that what we hear coming out of our representatives is that, you know, they really see as solving this problem in terms of legislative process, that they see the strength in terms of really forcing the process back on the president. You know, it's not just that, you know, the Congress has been denuded, but the executive branch entirely reduced down, you know, to the single personality of this one kind of enfant terrible in the guise of the president. And what the Congress is really trying to do is this Herculean process of reestablish the primacy, you know, of the legislative system. And, you know, there are going to be some hiccups as we move forward there. But, you know, what I saw, and the reason what I was writing back against in that blog post was a real explosion of cynicism in amongst activists in the Netroots, which I saw as potentially really problematic, this kind of throwing one's hands up and really losing all kind of faith in the ability of our new elected Congress to do anything. And while I agree with some of the arguments about character weakness and the ability to show backbone, I think ultimately the Democrats are the chance that we have in the short run in order to stop this policy.
Well, that and we do need Republican support. There is no question, given the narrow margin in the Senate, that you can't get to 60 votes without some that have R's behind their names. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. His website, frameshopisopen.com. Drop by and you can read this piece for yourself. Got a couple of listeners who I think have comments in your range. Let's go to Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington. Rebecca, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B., and he is Jeffrey Feldman.
Thank you. I know of both of you very much and appreciate your good work. I have two frames, Dr. Feldman?
Yes.
I have two frames I'd like to mention to you, and I love your website, by the way. One is the frame that the Republicans created after 9/11, and they referred to the terrorists as, quote, people in the shadows. And the Democrats have kind of picked up on that and used it, and as well as the Republicans, to describe undocumented workers, which frames them in a very negative, criminal kind of light. I'd like your response on that. And then I have one other that I think is very important I'd like to ask you about.
All right. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, I think that what Rebecca is talking about is something that happened actually quite a long time ago when the Bush administration first started talking about immigration, rather than talking about Latinos and Mexicans in this country, the current wave of immigration, actually using that phrase, people in the shadows, and the importance of bringing people out of the shadows. And I think that the way to reframe that is to actually shine a light on that quite literally and to really force into the conversation the idea that we're talking about a Latino immigration wave here, that we are all a nation in some senses of immigrants, and that the key here is not to whip up a wave of racism in response to that particular idea of a lurking menace, but to have a serious conversation about the best way to bring this new wave into our country.
Okay. And I'm sorry the call dropped there, so we couldn't get to her second point, but I thank you for checking in. Let's squeeze in one more. Ellen in Lowell, Massachusetts. Did you have an issue related to rhetoric and framing?
Yeah, I was talking about rhetoric. I think I sent you an email and thought you were Peter V and not Peter B, and then I resent it to you, so you might get to see it.
Okay, I did see it. Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead briefly, please.
Go ahead and say it?
Yeah, but I only have about 20 seconds.
Okay,
I'll tell you what, Ellen, why don't you hold on? Jeffrey, you hold on. After the break, we'll get your thought. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Hey, it's a beautiful day around San Francisco Bay. I'm Peter B. Collins here in the city of St. Francis, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. I'll be back again tomorrow at the same time, same stations. Hope you'll join us. Tom will be live on Thursday, and then I'll be here again on Friday as he continues his visit to Dubrovnik, Croatia. And that's where the broadcast will originate from on Thursday. We got to wrap up with Jeffrey Feldman. His website, Frame Shop, is open. It's very powerful stuff. His new book is called Framing the Debate. And we held Ellen over from the last segment. You wanted to talk about being at the mercy of translators, Ellen. Please explain.
When we were talking about the wording of things, I took quite a bit of coursework in translation between Spanish and English. And I remember my professors just about jumping up and down on the chair saying, you're at the mercy of the translator. There's no such thing as one-to-one correspondence. Anytime anyone chooses any way to say it, you're at that person's mercy as to how things get said, how things get explained, and how things get understood.
Well, and imagine that Bush needs multiple translators when he's now in the Czech Republic. One to try to explain what he meant, and then, of course, to translate it from English to say Czech. Jeffrey, are we at the mercy of translators in so many cases?
I think we are at the mercy of translators, but in many ways politics takes place at a very basic level of language, what I call the level of principles and values, rather than at the level of kind of specific statements. So, you know, principles are much broader, you know, ideas about, you know, we're a nation of people and laws, concepts such as inclusion and participation, deliberation. These ideas are much bigger than any individual sentence, so they can be expressed in many different ways. And in that sense, we're not really at the mercy of our translators, but we really can be very empowered as long as we do the work of translating, initially, of stating our politics in terms of principles.
Well, and the fur that's already flying between Putin and Bush before they even convene is fascinating. I think that the translators are going to have a field day at the G8, and then they get to go to kind of Bunkport the 1st of July for a Putin-Bush summit. That's going to be interesting. Ellen, thanks for your call. Jeffrey, thank you for your work. We'll talk again.
Thanks, Peter.
Jeffrey Feldman again, frameshopisopen.com, his website. Victoria Jones joins us now with an update from Washington at the Talk Radio News Service. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing better because Scooter got 30 months.
He did get 30 months. He could have got more, but then, of course, he could have got nothing at all. So, yes, he got 30 months. He also got 2 years probation after that 30 months. We mustn't forget that.
Okay, and a $250,000 fine.
Yep, which is not chump change, although obviously there are all kinds of funds that have been set up to make sure that he has all the money that he needs, so I don't think it'll be difficult for him to pay that. But what will have him sweating bullets at the moment is the appeal, and he's free at the moment pending the appeal hearing, which is next week. But then we've got the hearing next week, and after that we don't know whether the judge is going to say, you know something, during this appeal process you're going to go to the pokey and do the time, or whether he's going to say, yeah, you can stay out while we appeal.
Well, there's an interesting angle. I was talking with a legal expert about that yesterday. And for Judge Walton to free him on, you know, until his appeals run their course, Walton essentially has to rule that his trial court either, you know, committed errors or is vulnerable to appeal. And so the judge has to kind of fall on a proverbial sword there and say, reverse me. And given the tenor of this trial and the comments that the judge made at sentencing this morning, it doesn't seem likely that Walton wants to say this is an appealable verdict.
This judge is very unlikely to reverse himself on appeal. He said, people who occupy these types of positions where they have the welfare and security of the nation in their hands have a special obligation to not do anything that might create a problem. Well, you know, he also said the evidence overwhelmingly proved Libby's guilt. That's pretty clear, I think.
Now, do you think that this is going to change the posture of the White House? Because they've been torturing the argument that they cannot comment on the Libby case or the plane leak.
Yeah.
Until the trial is concluded. Well, I think we are at the end of the line here. Has the White House indicated that the president will have a statement sometime?
You know,
maybe.
I am one of the most pesky reporters at the White House when it's come to asking questions about Scooter Libby. In fact, I asked a question that was used during the trial. And I would be ecstatic if they would change their tone and start answering questions. But I think I can say with 101% certainty, they will say that because of the appeals process, they can't talk about an ongoing case.
Oh, my. And did you see the send-up on Comedy Central's Daily Shows about 2-3 weeks ago where they put together all the clips of the White House evasions? Oh, can't comment, can't comment, can't comment. And I guess they'll just have to extend that.
They're just going to have to extend. I didn't see it, but I see it every day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Victoria, anything else you want to add?
That's the main thing. I bring you greetings from London. I've just spent a week in London where the big stories are they're trying to extend their terror laws. They're trying to make them even more ferocious against the British public, which is being met with horror by the British public. So things over there are very like things over here.
And what was it like to be there with a $2 pound?
It's, you know, if you go to a Chinese restaurant and everything's like $4.95,
yeah.
Just except $4.95, everything's £4.95.
Uh-huh.
You just substitute a pound for a dollar for everything. Everything's double.
Yeah. All right, Victoria, thank you for that update from Washington.
Thank you very much.
Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News Service. I want to thank everybody who participated in the program today, FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, also Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We talked with Elizabeth De La Vega, former assistant U.S. attorney. And you heard our special report on the RNC's fundraising operation, which was suspended mysteriously last Friday. Thanks to all of you, and thanks to Lauren Kirshner and Chris Lopresto in New York at Air America Control. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same radio stations. If you want to find out more about me, visit my website at peterbcollins.com. You can also send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.